Good morning. This is Robert J. Sawyer. I'll see you in the future.
Good morning. Welcome to Too Much Grown for September 28th, 2021. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm pre-October Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Fedora.
Pam's back. It's the end of the month. We get to be smarter, Chip. We get finally 3 weeks without Pam. And we got dumber for the last 3 weeks. So it is in defense of stupidity. This is you coming in to share with us some part of your intellect against stupidity.
Do you think that the return to school is a part of that as well, Steve?
I'm trying to make children smarter, and as a result of trying to make children smarter, I think I lose a little bit of my intelligence each and every day.
I'm doing a little bit of reading, Steve. I'm using the, I heard that you can take these symbols and you can make them into words, so I'm working on that.
Down, get
film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. Hey, Chip, did you go to the movie theater and see anything this week?
I did not go to the movie theater, Steve, but I did see some things.
I finally got a chance to see the documentary Street Gang, How We Got to Sesame Street. This is a documentary that I have been waiting to see. It came out theatrically, and it did the documentary film circuit, and I finally got a chance to stream it. This is a wonderful look at the birth of Sesame Street, how we got to the point where we had this iconic piece of television, and all the people that it took to put together this educational commercial. And I've read the book, a terrific book that came out in 2009 by the same title, Street Gang, by Michael Davis. And so I knew most of the stories, and I knew that the invention of Sesame Street was based on kids love commercials and jingles. Let's bring education and letters and numbers into a jingle format, and their little minds will soak this up. But hearing those same stories from the actual people who were there that made this happen was enlightening.
So is this the education part of it? Is it the producers and the writers of it? Or are they the actors and the artists and things of that nature?
It was all of the above. The producers, Joan Ganz Cooney, who is the spark that made this happen, along with John Stone, are featured heavily. The two people that made Sesame Street are there. Jim Henson, unfortunately, is no longer with us, so we can see some archival footage of him talking about Sesame Street in the past, but he's not here with us to share. So we get stories from his family about how this all came together. Then we get the actors. We have Maria and Gordon. Unfortunately, the first Gordon is no longer with us. He passed away. Matt Robinson is the father of Holly Robinson Pete. I did not know that until I watched this documentary.
Well, then fill us in on who is Holly Robinson Pete.
You don't remember Holly Robinson Pete from Head of the Class? She married the football guy whose last name is Pete, and they have those terrible commercials about weight loss.
No.
Really?
I don't. I have no idea who you're talking about. But that's not wonderful because I know that they're actors.
Okay. So, yes, the actors who are still with us are joyously celebrated in this documentary, and we get to meet them now in the 21st century and hear their recollections of all of the work, all of the joy, all of the sweat and tears that it took to put this production of Sesame Street together to make it the thing that I still love Sesame Street to this day, even though it has evolved a lot from those first early days.
It certainly was an experimental time on during a television at that time. They're still figuring out what to do with this technology. And certainly television shows are much more effective at grabbing their viewers and meeting the expectations and what the viewers are looking for. But during that time, there was, you know, what you just described, this idea that somehow advertising was able to hook people into watching it. What if we string together this and aim it towards children?
Mm-hmm.
You know, take the, I guess, the advertising part out of it, but the stickiness, you know, remains.
That's right. Pam, are you a fan of Sesame Street?
I've actually never seen it, but I've heard great things about it.
It's wonderful. It's joyous.
There's a big bird.
I heard that. And it's not as I've heard.
Well, you know, no, most of us can't see Snuffy, but Big Bird could. And there's a guy who lives in a can, a trash can.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of angry about it.
Clint Eastwood, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
You got Beckett's, a chance.
Beckett's Endgame is about people in a trash can. Very similar.
bringing the literary too much scrolling, Professor Pamela Bedore, ladies and gentlemen. Chip, you got to see a man in a trash can this week. That is Clint Eastwood's latest movie, Cry Macho.
Well, I don't know if he was in a trash can, but this does star Clint Eastwood really struggling to deliver those lines and having actors really like reading lines to him. This was so bad. This was on HBO Max. It was just released. Clint Eastwood is such a treasure. Unfortunately, this is a terrible, terrible movie. I would say, you know, 25 out of 100 would probably be a good part of it. And I think that the lines, the writing has a lot to do with it. The actors just not having chemistry. And it just, I just felt like it was painful watching these people interacting with each other. I don't know how I've recently caught on to this, but it was painful. And it could be because of how they had to record it. Did they record it during the pandemic? And, you know, just have to be away from each other. But regardless, this was not a good movie, and certainly, you know, it's a sad commentary on, you know, the work of Clint Eastwood at this time in his life.
That is sad to hear that somebody as iconic as Clint Eastwood, as like you said, a treasure that he was, maybe we need to think about that as we age, and maybe we need to step away in our prime instead of, you know, playing basketball when it's too late for you.
Well, I would suggest that Eastwood's eye for cinematography is still very high. Maybe he should have picked someone else. But I would say that there may have been a budget constraint to this, but the actors, it wasn't just Clint Eastwood. Clint Eastwood was just reading bad lines back to the other actor. That other actor's got to interact with them, and it just wasn't very good. I do not recommend this. Unfortunately, this is not a good movie. You can watch it on HBO Max if you choose to. Riff Tracks, I'm sure, will.
I don't think so. I don't know that Riff Tracks will touch this one. But you did see a good movie this week, though, right?
Well, I did see another one. It's a documentary called The Spark Brothers. The Spark Brothers is about a rock and roll band. Let's just call it a rock and roll band. They certainly were looking for commercial success. They started in the 70s, and they had 25 albums. Now, Steve, did you ever buy a Sparks Brother album growing up or recording?
I have never heard of this band. I watched the trailer when you put it into the show notes for this week, and I thought for sure this was a fake documentary. I thought that for sure these can't be real people. That's got to be Will Ferrell in a wig.
No, this is a real band. I did see them. They were kind of circulating during the alternative dance movement back in the 80s. But certainly, even on the fringe of that, and maybe because of their age, one of the questions is, where are they from? They certainly have the aura of being some overseas group, maybe in Britain. We did learn that they did have a stage where they did have a British band backing them up. But they're from California, and they really were on the forefront of a lot of trends. They initially had started to be kind of like a glam band, but they quickly were able to adapt dance music, computer synthesizers, stuff like that. It seemed to be like one step ahead of the market. And so bands like Depeche Mode or craft work certainly were influenced or may have been influenced by this. The Pet Shop Boys certainly have a very similar sort of presence, but they've been able to continue to perform. And as all artists would find out, you're hot and then you're not. You know, the Bee Gees are really, really hot until all of a sudden there's some kind of event. Comiskey sings Disco Stinks.
That blowed up real good.
And then the Bee Gees for many, many years were performing. No one was really coming to their concerts and, or buying their music. But Barry Gibb said, we can write songs that other performers will sing in their heads. Mm-hmm. Just Sparks Brothers. Never really Sparks, the band. Hit in the U.S. as hard as it did maybe overseas, and even that may be overstated.
It's a mystery to me. I don't understand how these people can exist for the last 40 years, and I've never heard the word Sparks before. Pam, have you ever heard of this?
Never heard of it.
Isn't that mysterious?
Wow. And all the bands that you say they influenced, I've totally heard of, so that's so interesting.
So I'm in North Carolina. And one of the biggest bands to ever come out of North Carolina is a band called Superchunk. And I'm assuming that both of you have never heard of Superchunk.
No.
No.
Nope.
Okay. They're out of Chapel Hill. They're huge overseas. So it's just one of those areas that maybe your market is not your home market. And the Sparks as a band, one of the testaments to their ability to last during a period of time, they had a 6-year period where they were recording almost every day. And just, they were having nothing hit. And they didn't have a contract or anything of that nature. They had saved their money. They were pretty frugal on what they were able they put away money, certainly allowed them to go through that dark period to be able to get to where they are now. Now, you know, how big of a concert would it be if they showed up? I don't know. Huh. But they've played in 5,000 seat arenas before. And they've played in the Hollywood Bowl before.
This is so mysterious to me. Looking at the trailer with so many stars contributing to this interview that they admire this band, I was sure that this was a joke that I was not in on.
Well, where would we see Sparks? I don't know. Are they Talking Heads? David Byrne? Probably.
It certainly has that feeling to me, looking at the trailer, seeing some of their videos that were presented in the trailer. I certainly thought about Talking Heads, for sure.
So they were affiliated with a manga/anime movie that just didn't materialize. They got involved with a French animated designer, I guess, and that kind of work. You know, at some point you have your beginning stage where maybe you hit it, and then at some point you start looking for other types of projects, and it could be movies, television, and you find a lot of rock bands and stuff like that, start working for the Cartoon Network or writing jingles. It could be any number of things, but they've been pretty true to what they set out to be. And they've made a living at it. How lovely for them.
And they've got a musical coming out called Annette that they wrote. And so maybe we're going to start hearing about them. This musical Annette that's coming to Prime Video stars Adam Driver and Simon Helberg. Let's put on our list of things that we've never heard of, Sparks. Pam, have you been watching anything for the last month?
Absolutely. I watch Netflix all the time, but I haven't been to the theater in so long. But I actually watched two things this past month that are like reminding me of the X-Files. So these are super different. So first of all, I watched The Chair, and I watched it the weekend before university started up again. And this is such an interesting, it's just like 6 or 8, like 30-minute episodes. And as I was watching it, completely enthralled, I thought, who would enjoy this other than English professors? This is a story of the chair of an English department who has to deal with all the bureaucracy and craziness that goes into running an institution of higher education. fascinating to me and my friends, and I honestly have no idea who else would have enjoyed it, but it was terrific. So anyway, I highly recommend it, but with that caveat that it's so specific.
If you're in an English department at a university, you will love chair.
It just sounds like a wonderful testament to all those people who, work for universities and want to be chair.
Right, but the jokes are so specific. And I'm like, would anyone think this is funny if they didn't teach first year writing? I mean, I don't know. But anyway, it had the best cameo. It was so fantastic from David Duchovny. Okay. Now, the other show that I'm watching is Sex Education. Season 3 just came out, also on Netflix. And this stars Gillian Anderson. So it was such a pleasure to see those two in two totally different things over the past couple of weeks. Now, Sex Education is, I think, one of the best, really frank discussions of sexuality that we have out there. It's really, it's a little graphic. So it might not be for every audience member.
Gee, I wonder who Pam's talking about right now.
For the Puritans among us. But but it does address really, really topical and important issues. Like how it's set in a high school. And, how do kids who identify as non-binary, how do they manage that in a high school setting? What about sexual assaults that aren't all out rape, but that are nonetheless really traumatizing for people? How do those get addressed? How do you do sex education in 2021? Really, it addresses so many fantastic topics. The characters are great. I love Gillian Anderson. It's so funny how, these 30 years later from the X-Files, it's still just such a pleasure to see that fantastic actor. So anyway, I'm highly, highly recommending both of the things I've been watching lately, The Chair and Sex Education.
Opening this week, there's some movies that have broad appeal and some movies that have very narrow appeal. The first one is Venom, Let There Be Carnage. This is the sequel to the Venom movie in the MCU, right, Chip?
It is not part of the MCU. Oh. This is Sony's version of Spider-Man and the Spider-Man character Venom. And Carnage is another one of the characters. Certainly, I don't know, probably these characters are 20 years old. Venom may be the most popular character, maybe over the last 20 years. I'm throwing 20 years out. I have no idea how long Venom's been around.
But so let me ask you this. Did you watch the first Venom movie?
I did not.
Neither did I. Pam, did you see the Venom movie?
I did not.
All right. Time for the sequel.
Well, the interesting part about this is there's two parts. One, it has Andy Serkis as our director. Mm-hmm. And many of us know him from Lord of the Rings, right? He was precious there.
He is in so many movies, but you almost never see his face. He is that motion capture actor and so, so good at motion capture acting. He was Snoke in Star Wars, very important character in the Star Wars trilogy.
Well, was he important? I mean, I think he got killed pretty quickly, Steve. I don't know why, but it seemed like he was very important, and then he wasn't. And then, he also was, the ape in Planet of the Apes.
Yes, that's where Andy Serkis's acting in the motion capture suit really shines. The facial expressions that were pulled from Andy Serkis to make that CGI ape, brilliant acting. So I think that he's going to be able to do well directing a motion capture kind of movie like Venom.
That guy who was the bartender at Cheers, he seems to have found something else to do, Steve.
Woody Harrelson, we've talked about many times on Too Much Scrolling over the years. Woody Harrelson is one of my favorite actors working right now. He, again, was in that Planet of the Apes movie. Remember? Woody Harrelson was in there, and we really got into the idea of how much Woody Harrelson can take on a role. I look forward to him playing Cletus in this movie.
Blah, 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 Steve.
I don't say blah, 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 Chip. Stop it. Oh, I see what you did. The Hotel Transylvania Part 4 is possibly, maybe coming to our screens this week.
Well, it is set to be released. I think it's going to be streaming. It looks like Amazon Prime is where it's going to be on. And it stars Adam Sandler, Steve.
No, no, it does not. Adam Sandler is not connected to Hotel Transylvania 4. He exited in number 3, and another voice actor is taking up the role of Dracula. But all of the other stars, all of Adam Sandler's friends, are in Hotel Transylvania. Transformania is the name of this one.
What is he, just too good for a fourth franchise?
I think that, believe it or not, I'm going to give Adam Sandler credit for being smart enough to jump out of this franchise before it was soured by too many sequels. He's not executive producing this. He is completely out of this production.
All right. Steve, which brings us to another franchise that maybe this shouldn't be made.
Oh, I disagree with you completely, my friend. Adam's Family 2, the animated sequel to the Adam's Family's animated movie from last year, is opening this week, and I am excited for this. I love the Adam's Family in every incarnation. The character development from the original drawings to today, I enjoy this storytelling.
Well, this certainly is based off of Charles Adams' characters. Correct. And the strip that brought it about. And obviously the television show that was beloved back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we have the latest version of it. Anyway, Adam's Family, Volume 2.
Speaking of beloved television shows, the prequel to The Sopranos is finally coming to our screens this week on HBO. This is called The Many Saints of Newark.
All right. Well, Steve, I have not seen The Sopranos, but you have told me for many years to watch The Sopranos.
Uh-huh. The Sopranos was phenomenal storytelling, great characters that you will fall in love with these characters, and having a prequel of those characters coming back is joyous.
Do you think I'd be able to watch it with like some linguine with a good clam sauce?
Yes, this is very Italian. We need, okay, so here's the thing.
Can I have some vino with this? And maybe some tiramisu at the end. You never know, Steve.
Call all of your stereotypes over to the house and watch this. This is very Italian. The title, The Many Saints of Newark, is the translation of the Italian Moltisanti, because one of the main characters of The Sopranos is Christopher Moltisanti. This is the story of his father and how his father, back in the 70s, became such an important part of the mob and brought a young Tony Soprano on board.
All right, so this looks pretty good. And I do love this genre of film, but I've just never watched The Sopranos. I guess I should watch The Sopranos.
The young Tony Soprano is played by Michael Gandolfini, the son of the late James Gandolfini. You remember, he died after The Sopranos, and now his son is playing the younger version of that character. I have very high expectations for this storytelling.
Well, Apple TV Plus has once again spent some money, Steve.
Yes, we get Jon Stewart back as our voice of reason, for telling us about the things that are happening in the news this week.
So is this going to be like the Daily Show?
This is the way that they're pitching this is it's like the Daily Show, but longer and more boring.
That's terrible.
What a pitch.
Jon Stewart is an incredibly witty person. And certainly The Daily Show was able to take news and, for good or bad, kind of poke at it a little bit. And
bring it to the people.
A lot of comedians were able to come on there and write. It certainly drove some of the narrative, especially when you got to see, when I say farcical things, basically poking and with the right amount of pressure, like, hey, listen, we say we're doing this, but this is really what's going on.
Right. My expectations for this are pretty low. I don't know that it will be the same as it was in 2009. The Daily Show started in 1999. Think about that. The Jon Stewart version of The Daily Show, and remember, he took over from the previous host. His version started in 1999 and went through 2015.
Did it really?
Life has changed a lot in the last 22 years. And Jon Stewart is definitely a self-deprecating sort of character. And the commercials for this are about his appearance and how he has low expectations for this. My concern is that writing piece that you spoke about, Chip. If the same writers from that original Daily Show are a part of this, then I'm on board. If it's just trying to find or recreate that from 22 years ago, I'm skeptical at best.
Well, think about the rotating. So let's just say Jon Stewart. Is this going to be weekly, ongoing? Yes.
Yes, this is a weekly program.
All right. Well, think about it. Today we watch the Jon Stewart show. Tomorrow we watch the David Letterman show. Mm-hmm. You know, the next day we watch the Conan O'Brien long form show. You could see how we are finding. I mean, this market is kind of maturing a little bit on mm-hmm. how to use streaming. These are fairly inexpensive to run, relatively speaking, to a full-blown television show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's the personality that's selling this. Jon Stewart seems to be a very capable person, charming, good interviewer. Let's see what he does.
Yeah, don't forget about Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. John Oliver being one of those Daily Show correspondents who then went on to do that long-form weekly show, which is very entertaining.
Well, Samantha Bee and, mm-hmm. and Stephen Colbert.
The list goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. Book it.
Brings us to our book it, our book of the week. The reason Pam has shown up and sat through all of our discussion of cartoons and Sesame Street, thank you, Pam, is because she brought us another great book to discuss this week.
Yeah, this is one written in 1972. So the year I was born, Isaac Asimov. This is one of his most studied novels. So Asimov wrote just over 500 books in many, many, many genres, a lot of nonfiction, and obviously very, very well known for his science fiction. This is a guy who was writing constantly. He actually had, I read his autobiography, I, Asimov, and he talked about how he would always have 7 or 8 typewriters on the go. He would be working on multiple projects at once. So he would just sit down at the typewriter that he wanted to work on. And this novel, The Gods Themselves, is, you know, one of the more studied of his many, 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 many books. I hadn't read it in like 20 years, but when we were reading Project Hail Mary, it really reminded me of some of the similar themes of this novel. And it was such a pleasure for me to reread it. But I'm really curious. I think it was a first read for you guys. How is this like almost 50-year-old book? How did it work for you?
Well, it was hot and cold for me.
I can see that.
It's basically 3 different parts. So the first part, I was all in. I was like, wow, there's something really going on here. They're asking a lot of big questions. Certainly a lot of challenging stuff. We get to the second part and we get to left and right and blah, blah, blah. And it just got bogged down in a lot of that. By the time I got to the third section, I came back. I was like, oh, so this is what's going on. And we're on the moon. And it kind of set the scene. I felt that if I just read the first part, I got what I wanted out of it. Maybe you wrap it up in a bow, but I felt the second part of it kind of lost me a little bit.
And that is because of the way that this was written. The first part of this story was a short story, a standalone short story that Isaac Asimov wrote because of an interaction that he had with Robert Silverberg. Robert Silverberg, in January of 1971, made up a fake isotope, plutonium-186. And Isaac Asimov stood up and said, "You can't have plutonium-186. That's impossible. The laws of physics make that that impossible. And then Silverberg dared Asimov to write a story where the laws of physics didn't apply so that there could be a thing called Plutonium-186. So that's the short story that is the first part of this story, because he wrote it on a dare. Then his publisher said, oh, this is good. You got to write me a full novel about this. And so that's why the second part is so different from the first. And the third part is so different from the second, because it was the way that it was published.
Well, and it's so interesting. Like, I love that story because it brings you back, well, to a time, you know, before we were readers. But in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s, you really had pretty much like an all-male science fiction writing group out there, and they knew each other. So like Robert Silverberg and Isaac Asimov, two of the biggest writers of the time, totally knew each other. They would meet at conferences and conventions, and they would have these really, really hard science-y conversations. And so it's so funny when we think about science fiction today that like, I can't really imagine our major science fiction writers of the 21st century, like daring each other to create a fake isotope. Like, that's just such a...
You can't imagine that conversation being had between current authors. I think there's a lot of conversation that's still being had between authors.
Oh, they definitely have tons of conversations. But I mean, like, this is such a hard science question. Like, we have so many ways to imagine alternate isotopes, right? Like, that's just not a challenge for us 15 years later. It's been done and done and done. Like, we have so many notions of parallel universes, multidimensional spaces. Like, we, all of those, and we live in a postmodern time where our questions of like, what is reality? We're not so confident about that. So like, I just mean that dare, you could never imagine plutonium 186. Like, of course you can. Like, we just live in such a different time. I think it brings up this question about, like, how we construct reality.
And this is a story about parallel universes and the idea of gaining something in one universe and therefore losing that something in the other universe. And the moral conundrum in the first part of this is all about, well, if there's a parallel universe and if this is dangerous to one universe, should we stop doing it in the other universe? Is it our right to take this energy, or are we destroying something that we don't have the right to destroy?
That's where you get to the real philosophical questions that are being asked in that first part. I wanted just to before we start addressing that, I wanted to ask, was Asimov a mature writer at this time? I mean, had he written a whole bunch by the time this?
Yes. This is probably, I mean, I don't know exactly, but this would be in like the 200s, I would think, of his 500 odd books.
And this is the first time he wrote a book in 15 years. He took 15 years off of his novel writing to be an actual scientist, and then came back to, this is the first novel in 15 years.
And he wrote tons and tons of nonfiction in that time. I mean, he wrote extremely extensively. He even wrote some actually extremely well-respected work on Shakespeare. He wrote in all fields, this guy.
I've got a copy of that right there. Uh-huh.
Well, what I took from this book was just how skilled it was to take very complex ideas and then bring them down to the everyday person, and then to jump off to more complex ideas. It was a constant battering of mature thinking ideas. And where it really plays into is, I can see how reading this type of literature grooms scientists. You know, a person who wants to, because what ends up happening is, once you are introduced to great questioning, which basically all science and all writing and everything comes from great questions, then you can start moving your body or your mind to that area of deeper thought, of recognizing that, you know, there's a surface way of thinking, and then there's a depth that you can go into. And how to think like a scientist would be one of the things I immediately jumped out to me as I was reading this book.
That's absolutely my origin story. Reading these stories, the ABCs of science fiction, Asimov, Bradbury, and Arthur C. Clarke, reading those stories in my youth and seeing the possibilities of what science can do, what questions we have that can be answered. I put a poll out on our Twitter and I asked, who is your favorite of the ABCs, Asimov, Bradbury, or Clarke? And 50% of those respondents said Bradbury is their favorite of the three, because maybe he was the most pop of the three. Ray Bradbury had a TV show and all the Martian Chronicles and the Ray Bradbury Theater. Asimov, I think, is my favorite of the three.
Easily. Even though I love Bradbury and Clark, but I also, Asimov, easily my favorite, is including his nonfiction. And obviously, I've only read like a teeny tiny sampling of his 500 odd books, but he's just, it's exactly what Chip just said. I think he really does these very, very complex ethical and scientific explorations, but in a way that feels like pretty straightforward and easy. And I think that's why reading Andy Weir reminded me to go back and read this 50-year-old book, because this is complicated physics that we're reading, but it doesn't feel complicated.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But definitely it feels as if it was thought out.
Oh,
and
definitely.
And it wasn't that I have introduced something that I can't explain. There's sort of an explanation behind it. And the idea that one universe is, adding something and another one is subtracting stuff is a very simplistic way into taking a complex idea and just bring it to the masses.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of origin stories, I love the origin story with Silverberg, which creates the first part. So then in Asimov's autobiography, he talks about when he finished, this is a quote, "Also, when I finished the first part of the book as an independent novelette with no intention of doing more at the time, Doubleday urged me to make a novel of it and showed a copy to a paperback editor while I was thinking. I was told the paperback editor said, couldn't he put sex into it? And Doubleday said austerely, of course not. Asimov never does. So I did. I put sex into the second part." And I think it's so funny that there's sort of a dare that's not like as explicit as Silverberg's dare, but there's that idea like his publisher's like, we would love science fiction that has a little sex in it. And this guy just gives us science, science, science. So he thinks, okay, I can do it. I can put sex in it. And this is one of the real question marks in terms of the reading of this novel is in 1972, we are just at the beginning of feminist science fiction. We're just at the beginning. Ursula Le Guin has now published a couple things, Joanna Russ, C.L. Moore. So some of these major, major women science fiction writers who are going to become central to the genre in the 70s, 80s, and 90s have just started. And there was this sense that like these old guys have this sort of puritanical science stories. And I think that's a challenge that Asimov really tried to address. But is he successful? And that's a real question mark. And it's so funny, Chip, that you were like, oh, you like the first part, the second part got you a little bit lost, and then you like the third. Whereas I had the opposite experience of I love the triad. I just love the pair of people, Adua, Odin, and Trit. They're three of my favorite aliens. And so, but I think that that's really, it's an open question of how successful Asimov is in this novel.
Well, could that also explain the ending? Wasn't the ending about it like a sex scene or something like that? There was just a touch of that.
Well, part three is so interesting, right? Because it's looking at the lunar population and the Earth population and the fact that just physiologically, it's so difficult for them to actually engage in sexual activity together. But with love, my friends, we could maybe try it out. So he comes back to it. And I think a rather more clumsy, to me, part three, the sexuality in part three is very clumsy for me. But I think the sexuality in part two is fascinating. But I'm still not 100% sure if I think it's successful or not. And I've thought about it for a long, long time.
It feels so tacked on to me. It feels like that origin story is the reason why he decided to write this story. and it feels tacked on.
What feels tacked on?
The sexuality of the moon and
The moon part, yeah.
Yeah. How this this woman and there's talk about how he looks at her breasts and there's a whole conversation about the gravity and how gravity affects humans and get to the science.
Well, I think you're right. If you could edit this, and let's just say we were making a movie, you could, in my opinion, you could almost cut out the second part. You could cut out a lot of the third part and just basically work off that first part. Now, and that would be me, because I think that the great questions are being asked in the first part of this, and the banter that goes on and the ethical parts are just, they're fascinating. The second part would be its own standalone. I mean, there would be a whole different type of program.
And that one would sell tickets.
Probably.
And I completely disagree with you, Jeff. Okay. So this story is, I love that it tells you at the end of the first part, he tells you where the title comes from. And Asimov loves doing that, by the way. So this is from a Friedrich Schiller quotation: "Against stupidity, part one, the gods themselves, part two, contend in vain, part three." Now, I actually put this out on Twitter because I was prepping for this, and I just put out that Schiller quotation, noting that it's the basis for a great Asimov book. And one of my friends wrote back, "Wow, this is a quote for our times." Mm-hmm. And right? Like, against stupidity, the gods themselves contend in vain. There's nothing you can do against human stupidity. And we can think of lots and lots of examples, I think, throughout the history of humanity, but perhaps certainly it's easy to think of examples from our current day that would play this out. But this is the thing, this book is in three parts. So that first part is against stupidity, right? And there's all these ethical and moral conundrums, but there's also the apparent solution to the ongoing energy question. Mm-hmm. Free, clean, accessible, universally available energy that you think you've got it without any cost. And then the gods themselves, part two is so important because who are the gods themselves? Well, they're this really problematic society where people are in triads and they don't fully understand their own biology. And it's like the gods themselves are pretty interesting. And then contend in vain. Now, Asimov adds a question mark to part three so that the title contend in vain, like maybe the gods don't contend in vain. Maybe we can work against stupidity. And that's what he's showing us in part three. So to me, this is an absolute tripart novel with each part being equally important. But that's my reading of it.
So initially I thought this book, we were reading it because it was a climate change book, or at least we could read it as one now. And that's where I think the great questions come through in the first part. Now, it changes, throughout the book.
I love the metaphor in the second part where the other creatures use the word energy and food equally. That is the same word to them. That's an intriguing metaphor for our current energy crisis.
Right, because they photosynthesize. So that's how their bodies function, is through photosynthesis. So they think of energy and food as equivalents.
And we should too, because the process of photosynthesis certainly leads to food, which leads to energy in our existence. I love that.
So the background of this story is we have this free energy. Somehow we've learned how to make energy. And the idea is it's being passed to make this, it's being passed from one universe to a parallel universe. And each universe is incredibly slowly dying. The questions get later on, maybe it's accelerated, but the reality was, at least as we understood at the beginning of it, it was like, I don't know, a billion years in the future, this could be an issue. We'll think about it between now and then, or millions and millions. It doesn't really matter. It's so far in the future. And then sort of, is there ethics wrapped around that? Mm-hmm. I found that to be a great question, a great exploration, and what I would say the perfect type of story to bat around in the science fiction world.
And that's what we were contending with in the Ministry for the Future that we read during the pandemic, is this idea of what is the discount for the future? If we need it now, can we spend that energy today? And then the future generations, they don't get a vote because they're not alive. That's, I was definitely thinking of that while reading this.
And then I also love, Chip, what you just said, that this really tracks with the climate crisis debates that we're having today, even though being written 5 decades ago, it's not specifically addressing the climate crisis because you didn't have the data, but it still is addressing the problem of energy that's really central to the climate crisis. Like, I love this metaphor of the energy pump, which basically this scientist, Dr. Hallam, he actually gets the blueprint for how to create the pump from the para universe when it's etched out on tungsten. And he basically takes total credit for it, right? So this energy pump was 100% designed by the para universe. Humans don't know how it works. And we find out in the third part, they can't build one on the moon. Because I don't know, like they actually don't know how to get it started.
Right.
Just follow the instructions of the para universe. And so there's this sort of typical male scientist competition happening in the first part. And this is something Asimov was really, really interested in. And this is one of the reasons I like Asimov so much, is that even though he was living at a time when there weren't a lot of women in science, and certainly women had a really, really hard time making a real impact in fields of STEM, Asimov was always really, really encouraging and open to young girls pursuing STEM. That was something that he thought was super important. The basis for why he thought that is something that we might challenge today, but, and you see this in this novel, he felt like women have a sense of intuition that is crucial to scientific breakthrough, and that when you're leaving women out, you're leaving out this whole epistemological frame. And so that's both like something that I love that he thought that, and I'm also like, well, like it's like women and men aren't like such distinct creatures. Like the men are from Mars and we're from Venus model is maybe not one we use for gender anymore.
Sure, give us the one with the monsters.
Okay. But yeah, so in this first part, we do get like a real like embodiment of so many of our concerns in 2021, but written in 1972.
That intriguing piece of intuition versus data and what makes good science. I know that we're reading hard science fiction here, and I love hard science fiction. The idea of this is how physics works, explained, like Chip said, in a way that is entertaining, is wonderful writing. And I see where he's going with the idea of the stuff we don't know, maybe we have to have a degree of luck. We have to have a degree of intuition to find the answers. But it left me a little flat still.
Mm-hmm. No, I could see that. I think the other thing that's really interesting, and I bet you like this too, Chip, in the first part, is this notion of like, what do you do when you find out there's a problem with a technology that you really love, right? And so one of the things you could do is just pretend there isn't a problem, right? You love this technology, let's not pay attention to the problem. And he uses the example of tobacco. And this is a more fresh example in 1970 than it would be today.
Wait, listen, my ears just perked up. I'm in North Carolina and you're talking about the
and
gold.
You're from 1970.
You're talking about the gold leaf. Tell me more about that.
Right. Well, exactly. And so in this first part, one of the characters says, you know, when we found out that tobacco caused cancer.
Wait a minute. That's never been substantiated on any level.
And then 50 years passed and we still have the same conversation.
People... That's a smear campaign. And it's all public relations at this point. By the way, did you say that Philip Morris International is getting out of the cigarette business and they're going into healthcare. I just want to throw that out there. That is a
wow.
First, you make the virus, and then you make the antivirus. I get it.
But this is the thing. Here's what Lamont says: he says, look, if we find out that tobacco causes cancer, the really logical thing would be to say, oh, let's not use tobacco anymore. But that's not what we do. We think, okay, how do we create a cigarette that doesn't cause cancer instead of not smoking? And I mean, I think that's kind of a good comparison, right? Like, if we know that burning fossil fuels is going to create a massive problem that's not that far away and that we're already seeing some of the impacts from, couldn't we just stop burning fossil fuels? And it's like, no, we can figure out a way to counterbalance the burning of fossil fuels. We could create more technology that will, you know, this is that Ministry for the Future versus Bill Gates approach mm-hmm. we talked about during the pandemic.
And that is, I mean, that is why he's so good at asking questions, because that's the great question. You know, it wasn't don't do that. It was like, well, we'll just figure out a way to do it, but, you know, it's less harm.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, I mean, it is that's the brilliance of it. That's why I was like, this is asking great questions. And those just continue to kind of bop back and forth.
And that is true of all of Asimov's work. It is brilliant in its asking those questions and facing that mirror at us and going, here's what you're doing. Is this what you should be doing? And can we do better?
And I think that the brilliance of the scenario is exacerbated by part two, by the fact that the gods themselves exist. So in this first scenario, the impact to humans is going to be quite far in the future, but we have no idea what the impact is to the para-universe. Right. So, you know, that if this is causing our sun to heat up, it's got to be causing their sun to cool down. And mm-hmm. so, but to what degree, we don't know who they are. We don't know what they look like. We don't know anything about their world. We can intuit or even sort of theorize some things about the physical properties of their universe, but we don't know anything about them.
Do they have rights? There's the other part that's really fascinating about it. Do right? they have rights? Even if we knew, right or
and
wrong.
And what are the ethics of how you treat another set of beings that you don't know the first thing about?
Mm-hmm. And we can't communicate with them in his storyline. Where they find a way to communicate with us, they somehow, you know, can figure out language that we can understand. And we try to send them language and it doesn't work out the same way.
This is like a college class. In a book.
Yeah. That's Isaac Asimov. I really think that we should read more of these sorts of classic sci-fi, because this is the way that I understood a lot of the world of science back in the, well, in the 80s, let's be fair.
Oh, I love that you say that, Steve. I think that's so important. And I always want to teach some of the classic stuff, and then I want to be more relevant to the students, but you're right. You do learn so much from these novels. Yeah.
But at the same time, Chip is right that there is a lull to this story. There's that classic piece that is very 70s, that is very taking away, that, how would I say this?
Do you that, work into this? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I'm jumping on to you. In the sense of, you have to have enough contemporary stuff that kind of grabs you a little bit to be able to explore the history of these types of novels. And this would be a history of this type of novel.
I suppose that we went to this novel because we read the contemporary Project Hail Mary. I suppose that we are backtracking to, oh yeah, but all of science fiction is really, it owes its existence to the ABCs. Mm-hmm. Asimov, Bradbury, and Clark wrote so prolifically all of those short stories. Oh my goodness. I don't know a single author in that genre who could claim that they never read anything by those three guys.
Well, even if they didn't, they were inspired by somebody who read it.
Correct.
And there's the jumping on part. When we were reading all of the Sherlock Holmes short stories, what did that give us? It gave us a large body of short stories, and then the four novels, that we could jump on, and we could create a Batman type character, or we could create a Indiana Jones type character. I mean, you could create any type of jumping on point, but you have that body of work to draw on. Basically, it gave you the skeleton to add your story to.
Mm-hmm.
I do this thing with my husband where we go for walks and I tell him stories from books that he's never going to read. And so yesterday,
that is brilliant.
That is like, great. That's
how to become literate without ever reading.
Because I read a lot, right? And he reads, he reads like maybe one book a month and I read like three books a week. So he's like, I'm never going to read all those books, but I'd love to hear the stories. So I was telling him this story and he kept going, whoa, whoa, whoa. This is exactly like the Brandon Sanderson book I'm reading right now. Brandon Sanderson being a contemporary fantasy writer. And he just kept stopping me and being like, whoa, that's like the book. That's like the book. That's like the book. And I wouldn't even suggest that Brandon Sanderson is referring specifically to the gods themselves, but it's exactly right. Like that foundational work that Asimov did, and he actually has that.
Yeah, I was about to say, pun intended.
I know, sorry.
Foundation is coming to our TV screens this year. They're making a drama series out of Foundation on Apple TV, and I look forward to that one.
Definitely. But anyway, So guys, let's talk about part two. So Chip has already told us. Steve, what did you think of part two?
I got lost in it. I wanted it to be more specific to the event of the science, not to the relationships of the beings. I got lost and a little frustrated in the morality play that we were reading and the metaphor of our existence, the lefties and the righties, the softies and the hardies, and how when you age, you used to be a softie, and then when you get older, you become a hardened sort of being. And I was like, yeah, I gotcha. Fine. It's a metaphor. I got lost in the metaphorical piece of it.
Interesting.
I'm going to have a similar sort of experience. I was reading it and I kept going, okay, get me to the point. Okay, what's it doing to this universe? And all right, and I was just, instead of going through the relationship part and understanding how these beings were interacted, I was much more interested in how these two universes or parallel universes were communicating back and forth. It just seemed to go in an area that I wasn't prepared to or even interested in going. I was much more interested in the science part of it.
Mm-hmm. That's where I was. And you know how much I love relationships in stories, but this one seemed so tacked on to the science that I didn't enjoy it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try and make a small argument for part two, even though I won't change your minds, and that's totally fine, because I loved this part.
Well, I'm just a simpleton, so you can just give
you're saying it wasn't the science. Well, so here's what I thought was really interesting. Within book one, Against Stupidity, you do have Lamont and Dennison to a lesser degree saying, you guys, like the paramen, as they called it, the people of the para-universe, the paramen are way smarter than us. They're the ones who came up with the design for the pump. They can communicate with us. We don't know how to communicate with them. They are more intelligent than us. And of course, for a scientist like Hallam, who's like father of the electron pump, he's like, no way. And then they're like, well, we could call it more advanced if you want, right? So when we go to meet the gods themselves, and it's interesting that the title of the gods themselves is for our friends, Odin, Dua, and Trit, they don't seem that smart, right? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, we, the reader, are being moved from this like hard science fiction story that's all occurring in labs and at symposia. And we're being moved into this like weird world where, you know, we can't even picture these aliens, right? Now, I personally love aliens that are really hard to picture. It's just a preference of mine. The humanoid alien is one of my least favorite science fiction tropes. So I love aliens that don't fit on the page. And for me, I've read this novel a bunch of times and I can't picture these guys. They're made up of light and edges and they sun themselves. They have this space between their atoms. Odin's atoms are closer than Trit's and Dua's are super, super far apart. They can meld into the walls, but they're really not supposed to. It's really kind of not okay. You know, there's just something you have me at aliens that I can't picture. I'm just super excited about that. And maybe that's a personal preference. But I think Asimov is really playing with our expectations. Like we think to ourselves, oh yeah, these aliens are so much smarter than us. We're imagining like they have better lab coats. Like we're picturing it within our human frame. And instead he's giving us these completely unimaginable creatures.
They're not Vulcans, Steve.
and I agree with you completely, Pam. That is brilliant. The Vulcans and all of the Star Trek aliens are bipedal, two eyes, two ears, and a nose, and every creature in the universe is based on humanity. And I agree with you that this week in class, I had my students using a painting program to draw an alien. And I said to them, well, why does it still have two eyes? Why are the eyes there? What is it about this alien race that it has to be based on humanity?
I love that assignment, Steve. May I just say, like, I love that. I want to do that. Have people design an alien. It's just so, like, because it gets you into so many questions, right? Like, what ontological questions? What is it?
That's our assignment, by the way. Send us your pictures of aliens.
Yes.
Melding into walls and when that they're not supposed to meld into. Why do they have walls then? How did they make the walls? Where did the walls come from? I want to know about the walls.
Okay, so now, Steve, I understand that you didn't love that giant revelation that the soft ones never even imagined, that their triad of three could become the hard ones. And they can't make that move until they have the maturity to imagine it, right? Mm-hmm. So I actually, personally, I 100% hear what you're saying, that it's a lame metaphor for like the crustiness of old age. But I also love the idea of like, what do you get out of sex? So this is the question that is asked again and again, right? So Dua, our emotional, who like, by the way, a little bit more rational than emotionals are supposed to be. So she's a left M, which is a pretty bad slur. And again, I mean, there's so many ways that we know exactly what we know, all the different things that he's referencing there. But this notion, there's this moment where they want to have the third baby, right? And so one of the hard ones talks to Odin and says, okay, listen, what does each of you get out of melting? And so Trit, the parental, he gets the children, and children mean everything to Trit. He adores children. That's what he's designed to do. What about Odin? And I love this answer, that Odin gets clarity of mind. So after a sexual experience, after a melting in which he kind of loses track of time, loses track of his own body because they melt, their atoms intersperse, he actually has this huge clarity and he's able to do amazing scientific work, right? And I think that's the part of sexuality that we humans sometimes ignore, that like we can get additional clarity and through clarity and connection, we can actually have like more intuition and understanding. And then what does Dua get? Nobody quite knows what Dua gets out of it, right?
Right.
And she has this fear of passing on. And what passing on means is permanently melding with your partners. And that's a terrifying idea, right? It's like giving up yourself.
And I get the metaphor. The metaphor is being very specific. You know, this is the picture of sexuality in humanity, the male and the female, the what you get out of this act and what the female may or may not receive. I get it.
But I think that it gets mixed in with the other ideas being explored. And that's why they almost should be standalone stories. There's too much going on. I'm critiquing the entire work as opposed to this particular part, which, Pam, you've made much more interesting than when I was reading it.
but yeah, there. And by the way, like, this is a common critique of Asimov, just like of Sawyer, who is another descendant of Asimovian science fiction, is that, like, there's too many ideas in each book. But to me, there's something so exciting that an author would have so many ideas that even if they write 30 books like Sawyer or 500 books like Asimov, they're still putting like six interesting ideas in each book. Sure. It's so cool. But I think that one of the things that's fascinating, so Steve, the metaphor that you just laid out seems super, super clear until we come to the final melding, right? Mm-hmm. Now, with that final melding, these three creatures that we've come to know separately are going to become one. And oh, by the way, they've been doing it all along. Every time they meld, they become not just some random hard one, but the one who created the electron bomb. Ah! I just love that revelation so much.
I understand how you love it. I understand that the science, the idea of doing science needs all of the three parts. It is that triad to make the science happen. But boy, I was not as excited about it as you are.
Okay, fair enough. No. So the gods themselves, who you think of as very ungodlike and a little bit boringly metaphorical, who I think of as like a really interesting version of cool aliens. When we come to the third part, the part with a question mark, do the gods contend in vain? We've got Dua, who's trying desperately to communicate, stop the pump, you're killing yourselves and us. And she imagines, my goodness, this could impact up to 10,000 beings. Little does she know, it's actually billions and billions and billions of people who would beings and tens of billions who would be impacted. But as we get to the third part, which is, again, a whole new situation with three or six new ideas. Now we meet Dennison, who's this kind of unassuming middle-aged guy. And I love that, like, his body is so ugly and, like, he's just like this fairly fit, you know, 45-year-old guy, but on the moon, man, the gravity's not kind, right? And so he's this, like, paunchy, ugly guy.
Did you just picture Asimov at 45?
No, totally.
That this yes. was just his own self writing. 100%. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the fantasy of the like hot 32-year-old lunar girl who's like all into nudity. I know. But anyway, but Dennison actually then like tries to like play out the first two parts, tries to connect it all together. And states very clearly, you know, the easiest way to solve a problem is to deny it exists. But he says the way you solve a problem isn't by trying to make a cancer-free cigarette. It isn't by convincing people they don't need to smoke. It's by making something else that they want more. Hmm. Right. And that is the way that you get that you overcome the problem of stupidity. So that's why I think like it's such a three-part book. The para-universe is nothing. The gods themselves, the gods are nothing like what you think. But then the answer is that third option, right? Of creating something new. So I love when Dennison says two is a ridiculous number. And you're like, what? How is two more ridiculous than all the other numbers? It's like, well, one is a number because you think, oh, there's only Earth. There's only intelligent life on Earth. As soon as you know there's intelligent life somewhere else, you have to assume there's an infinite number of parallel universes and parallel worlds.
And that's where I get my, you know, Carl Sagan contact conversation comes right into there in this book. And yeah, the it is ridiculous. It is ridiculous to think that there's two planets in the universe, us and the Vulcans. That can't be. There's got to be more than that.
Yeah. If we could just put together a spaceship to go out and explore those, Steve. We'd have to have... Yeah, you know, maybe like some strict rules on non-interference and then break them.
So all the did time. You see the headline this week that William Shatner is going up on the next launch of the billionaires sending?
I didn't see that. That is awesome. Yes, ma'am.
William Shatner will be the oldest human in space coming up next month.
He looks a lot like that Galaxy Quest guy, right?
I saw William Shatner live. I guess it was right before the pandemic. I think it was in January of 2020. And I mean, he's 85 years old. He's fantastic. He just gave this awesome lecture and answered questions. He was funny and charming. And oh my goodness.
He's doing so
full disclosure for 85. He's Canadian.
That's what it is. It's all the
maple
syrup.
I was going to say, my countryman, William Shatner, but thanks for taking it for me.
So what do we think? Is this a book that we can suggest to our listeners as a book that they should read? Or is this just on the stack of books of Asimov that maybe some of our listeners should read?
I don't feel like I'm really qualified to answer that question. I'm so glad that it was brought to me and said, hey, you should read this. But I don't think I would have gone to pick this up on my own.
Pam, what do you think?
It's a great question, Steve. And so it's so funny because it's like a 50-year-old science fiction novel. So it's hard for me to say, okay, here, go read this book that's 50 years old. But at the same time, I have taught it a few times and students love it. So students do get into it. So I think it is worthwhile, but it's dated. Mm-hmm. From 1972. Like, it is what it is, right?
I agree with that. There is that classic science fiction element to it from 50 years ago, along with that backstory of how this came to be and the two very specific dares that Isaac Asimov decided needed to be put into this story. And to me, they still feel tacked on, not like the real thought that a science fiction writer had to make a story.
And certainly a great example of the evolution of scientific thought.
Yes.
So, you know, what they were thinking... That's where I think a lot of these books, they really kind of address the zeitgeist of that moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, today we have other things that we're thinking about. Are they more advanced? I don't know. A book written today with a current writer certainly may address these very differently. In fact, I would guarantee they would address these ideas mm-hmm. very differently.
And that's Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir.
Exactly. And I love that you say that, Chip, because I think that the book is both very dated, but also this notion, a lot of these ideas about like, how do you get like free, clean energy? We're still 100% grappling with that today. And again, as a teacher, I love showing students that even 50 years ago, people were grappling with this very question in a lot of the same ethical ways that we are today. Mm-hmm.
Well, they haven't met enough Tesla stuff. That's all I can say.
Read more about Tesla and watch more movies where David Bowie plays Tesla. That's the answer.
There's your answer right there.
Scroll with it.
Brings us to our scroll with it. Chip, there's a problem with our kids these days. Kids these days, Chip.
TikTok certainly has an impact on youth, and for good or bad. And it seems like there is a trend going on to destroy bathrooms and to basically record that destruction of the bathrooms. That's it's part of social media, and that this is a good example of some of the challenges we have with it.
Yeah, this devious licks is the name of this phenomenon. And the children are bringing their phones into the bathroom, bringing screwdrivers to school, and unscrewing parts of the bathroom and stealing pieces of our schools. This is international, by the way. This is not just a United States problem. This is an international phenomenon. And it's become a real trouble part of my school day.
But one of the challenges certainly would be a screwdriver could be considered a weapon, and you brought a weapon to the school. Regardless, it's showing the power of social media. Steve, let's talk about the real news this week. Netflix has announced Tiger King season 2. I don't know, back in prison? How do you even have a season 2 after the first one, Steve?
Pam, I'm so glad that you're here to hear the Tiger King news. We haven't heard any Tiger King news from Chip in months. Yes, let's all celebrate the prison of the men in the story. I still have never watched this, Chip.
Well, there's an opportunity to catch up, Steve. It's always streaming on Netflix.
Pam, have you tried to watch the Tiger King since Chip was so enthralled with it in the beginning?
Felt like it was such a joke that you and I had not seen it, and he just loved it, that I haven't been able to bring myself to watch even one.
All right. At least Chip has his Halloween costume prepared.
George Clooney dresses the Tiger King. That's what I'll do.
Love it.
All right. All right, we're heading into October. We're ready. We've got all of our cartoons of all the scary, spooky things. We've got the Tiger King. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do you think, Chip?
Only if we can come back next week, Steve.
What do you think, Pam?
Only if I can come back next month?
Next month. There you go. Only if I can come back next month. That's your new catchphrase. We love having you, Pam. Thank you so much again for coming in and bringing us this view into literature. And everybody who's listening, thank you so much for listening. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-410-4TMS. Our website is toomuchscrolling.com. Our email is toomuchscrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on iTunes and Spotify and Apple and YouTube. We're everywhere. I want to thank you again for listening in Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflug.
And I'm Pam Bedar.
We'll see you in the future. What I want to talk about is what I want to thank you for. What I want to